Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Amy Edmonds, stroke survivor and founder and chief executive of Young Stroke, and Dr. Lester Lung, neurologist and director of the Stroke and Young Adults Program at Tufts Medical Center, about the alarming rate of young stroke victims.
An important topic for many of our listeners, and one that we need to investigate further to understand why we're seeing more strokes in younger people. But first, we're going to talk about some other topics and some research that matters. Adam, a superbug appears to be spreading more and more in hospitals.
We hear about bacterial resistance all the time, and we hear about trying to limit giving antibiotics because we don't want people to get these resistant bugs. And now we're hearing about things that are even more scary, that these resistant bugs are able to kind of detect when the antibiotics are being, you know, and says, not only am I going to be avoiding and get resistant to this antibiotic, I can think that the next one you're going to give me and I'm going to get resistant to that. Is that really possible?
It is. These bacteria are very smart. And in this case, we're talking about a class of bacteria called CREs, or carbapenem-resistant enterobacter. Carbapenem is a type of antibiotic that is often a last resort for patients who are in the hospital. So for these bacteria to be resistant to this particular antibiotic, it is a signal that this class of antibiotics is not working, and that's a little scary. So the authors wanted to take a look to see about the genetic sequence of these bacteria and to see if they were spreading from patient to patient in hospitals and some of the properties about the bacteria themselves.
Yeah, they collected all these samples from several Boston hospitals. They published the work in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And I think the good news is they did not see really this capacity from like patient to patient within the hospital. But the bad news is they seem to have even more complexity than the researchers imagined. They have dozens, if maybe not hundreds, of ways to form the ability to adapt and perhaps overcome the antibiotics.
So, I mean, to me, this highlights, Adam, the importance of preventing infection with hand washing and what we know works. But avoiding unnecessary antibiotics on a public health level, but also in the importance, as we talked about several weeks ago on the show, of new drug development, of new antibiotics, and of more research to understand how these bacteria are making these adaptations.
Yeah, I think you're right, Christy. We'll need that new research. We also need the research on how to make our guts just more resilient without antibiotics and ways to resist infections, in addition to avoiding giving antibiotics when you don't need them. Speaking of avoiding things, you know how frequent in delivering prenatal care, postpartum depression and anxiety can be for any mother.
Yes, it is very, very common. And this is some research that was just published in Trends in Neurosciences, where they really tried to understand the properties and the brain and neurochemical elements happening with postpartum depression and anxiety as they relate or compare to other mood disorders like just major depression.
Yeah, and they actually did an MRI to look at the function of the brain, and they were comparing these women who had postpartum depression, which is now called perinatal depression, compared to the functional MRI in women who had not had children. And it actually, the MRI was different. These women with postpartum depression actually look and act different in their brain activity than the women who weren't pregnant and were depressed, which sounds like it's almost a different entity.
Right, right. And it's always been striking to me that although we do have certain patients, if you have depression in the past and you become pregnant, you're at higher risk to have perinatal depression. But then there are a lot of patients who it really just comes out of the blue. And so the fact that they are more distinct in the neurobiology, at least in this study, kind of rings true for some of what I see in our patients. But also just highlights that this is really common. 1 in 7 new moms are affected by this. It also affects their babies and has an impact on infant health. And so to have further study about this, there are only 20 publications looking at the neurobiology of the part or how what's exactly going on in the brain. And so we need to understand this more fully so that we can approach this more comprehensively and help people feel better sooner or better yet, help people prevent it. Okay, well, let's talk about breast cancer. This is a study about women who are treated for a precursor of breast cancer and then their longevity as you follow them out over 10 years.
Yeah, this was a type of precursor called ductal carcinoma in situ, otherwise known as DCIS. And it's one of these really kind of scary sort of diagnoses because some women with this DCIS go on to develop invasive breast cancer, but DCIS in and of itself is not an invasive breast cancer. So deciding what to do about the treatment and what does it mean long term is a real problem. And this was research that was presented at the European Cancer Congress of 2017.
What they did was they looked at almost 10,000 Dutch women who were diagnosed with this DCIS between 1989 and 2004, and then they tracked them over 10 years. They compared their death rates with that of the general population.
Yeah, and this – stay with us on this because it's a little confusing. But
it is.
The women who had DCIS over this period of time actually had a lower risk of dying from any cause, but they did have a slightly higher risk of dying from breast cancer. So those things aren't necessarily true and related. We'll try to tease out both of them.
Well, I think from the general population point, the women over 50 who had been treated for this ductal carcinoma in situ, they're more likely to be alive 10 years later than just people in the general population. And so they actually somehow are a population that live longer, according to the study. And to me, and I think to you, we were both just reading this before we turned the show on today, that highlights to us that, well, maybe they're just a healthier group of people that we're looking at. So maybe because they were getting their mammograms and because they were able to afford and have insurance or whatever it took to get those mammograms, that they were by nature already a healthier population or a group of women who were already more active about their health and therefore maybe pay attention to other things that make them healthier.
Yeah. So I think one of the take homes, at least for me of this, Christy, is that this ductal carcinoma, which when you put the word carcinoma, cancer, in any diagnosis,
it's
really scary, exactly. But it is different from breast cancer itself. And there's really good news for the great majority of women, not all women, but the great majority of women who have this diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. And I think that this information can be reassuring for patients who have that. And I'll also say if you're listening out there and you're listening to this and it sounds confusing, if nothing else, know that if you're over the age of 50 or between 50 and 65, you should be getting a mammogram at least every other year or about every other year for the general population. So if you haven't had your mammogram, it's a good time to get it.
Our last research that matters is about something that all of us would eventually face if we live long enough, which is disability as we get older. And we might have to go to the emergency room. And if we do, does that mean that even if we don't get admitted, let's say we have a fall, we go to the emergency room and we have a bruise or some other injury, does that mean that we're going to have more problems subsequently? What type of research is this?
So this is research where they were looking at 754 elderly patients who went to the emergency department but who were not admitted to the hospital and compared with another 813 similar people who didn't go to the ER. And they found that they had comparable functional abilities at the beginning, meaning they were very low on a disability scale to begin with, so pretty functional. But the ones who had an emergency department visit then scored 14% higher on that same scale over the next 6 months. It highlights that it's not the ER necessarily that did something bad to them. It may be the illness or the reason that caused them to go to the ER, but that we need to think more carefully about our discharge home from urgent care, from clinics, from emergency departments, that maybe these patients need additional home health, additional closer follow-up, physical therapy, the kinds of things that we would consider when they are discharged from a hospital. Maybe we need to consider that a little sooner in the process.
Yeah, what I found interesting, Christy, is that these patients on average were 84 years old when they joined the study, and they were living in the community independently. It suggests things change at certain times for a lot of people, and I do think more support recognizing that let's not wait till they actually fall and break a hip to get that extra support. I agree with you fully. Well, that will conclude our research that matters.
It does. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Amy Edmonds, stroke survivor and founder and chief executive of Young Stroke, and Dr. Lester Lung, neurologist and director of the Stroke and Young Adults Program at Tufts Medical Center, about the alarming rate of young stroke victims. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam and I will be talking with Amy Edmonds, stroke survivor and founder and chief executive of Young Stroke, and Dr. Lester Long, neurologist and director of the Stroke and Young Adults Program at Tufts Medical Center, about the alarming rate of young stroke victims. And we want to welcome you.
We'd perhaps like to start with you, Ms. Edmonds, and maybe tell us briefly about your story. I don't think most people, when they think about strokes, think about young people having strokes.
You're absolutely right. And my stroke was a very atypical experience. First of all, I presented symptoms of temporary blindness, which is something that many people don't generally associate with stroke. And I was also repeating myself. I repeated myself 3 times, and I happened to be in the presence of my mother, who was astute enough to know that that was a sudden change in behavior, and that's very important for people to understand that a stroke often occurs when there's a sudden change of behavior. And she immediately dialed 911, which is exactly the right thing to do. Something else that was unusual about my particular stroke experience is that I did not require rehabilitation post-stroke, and that is not always the case with younger survivors.
And how old were you at the time that you experienced this sudden blindness and repeating yourself?
I was 45.
45.
You know, I think this knowledge that something is different seems to be a really important facet. And I wonder, Dr. Long, if you can just speak to, is that maybe a common denominator that something is different and you don't know exactly what it is, but you know it's not normal?
I think that is an important thing to recognize. And one of the things that we have found with people that we take care of in our program and that other neurologists have discovered is that young adults with stroke, they may not really know what to expect. And it's hard to give people the advice just to come into the hospital when something is different. And part of that is because a stroke is related to an injury to part of the nervous system, whether it's the brain or the eyes or the spinal cord. And we don't really think about those parts of our body very much just because they're running quietly in the background. So when any of those are injured, there's a loss of function, essentially. Something that we normally take for granted is suddenly not working anymore. And that, I think, is a really important thing for people to recognize, even if it's hard to list the 20 or 30 or 50 different things that can potentially be a stroke symptom.
Although, Dr. Long, would you review for our listeners what are some classic symptoms of stroke, just so we're all clear on those most common ways? And then are there differences in the way that young patients experience or present with them?
Sure. So the most common symptoms that people have include having some difficulty with communication, whether it's expressing yourself in words or being able to understand what other people have to say. Sometimes the words themselves may come out poorly articulated, so the speech itself may not be clear. Sometimes people will lose vision on one side, whether it's in one eye or actually on one side of space. Another very common symptom that many people recognize is that it's possible to become weak on one side of either the face or the body or potentially both. And there are a number of other ones too, including having difficulty with coordination or loss of sensation or sometimes not paying attention to one side of the body.
You know, I'm thinking about a patient of mine who also in their late 40s sent me actually a text from a spouse about that after getting out of bed, they were, again, repeating themselves, kind of like you, Ms. Edmonds. And I think this kind of disbelief that they could be having a stroke. I wonder, Ms. Edmonds, if you could speak to what was the feeling like when you heard that, yes, indeed, you were having a stroke. What was that like for you, and then how did you adjust to it?
Well, that's a great question, because I have learned that stroke survivors come in two varieties. There are those of us who can remember quite explicitly the stroke experience and the sensation, even to being able to describe the sense of paralysis overwhelming their body. And then there are those of us who have recall of nothing, and I fall into that category. I have no memory of the stroke experience. I am totally at the mercy and the recall of my mother being able to share with me how I responded during that time.
And yet, you know, you had this stroke, which is a pretty profound experience and knowledge. Share with us a little bit about how you moved forward from there in terms of looking at your life and what changes or how that's impacted you.
Certainly, it does alter your self-image. I have always been a very confident woman and very unapologetic about going forward and doing whatever I want to do. And I've never been a very dependent person upon anyone. And certainly, post-stroke, I tell you, I look forward to my family reaching out to me to make a bed check every day. Because one very profound way that the stroke changed my life is that I no longer assume that I will make it through the day okay.
I think what you said is really a very important thing, and something that we found that oftentimes family and companions are really crucial to help people get to the hospital in time or to get to treatment.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Lung, let me ask you, does stroke in young people, why does it happen? I mean, I think when we think about strokes frequently, we think about, oh, people have high blood pressure, they have diabetes, and after they've had that for 20 or 30 years, they easily can have strokes, smoking, drinking too much. Is it the same way with younger people? What's different?
Thank you for that question. There are a lot of differences, and I think this is part of what makes it sometimes very difficult for young adults with stroke in terms of actually some of our messaging as a healthcare system and as a field in terms of helping people understand what happened. I think one thing that's important to recognize is that the things that we refer to as being risk factors are not necessarily the ways in which an injury can occur to the brain or some other part of the body. These are just things that contribute to something happening, a mechanism. And in young adults, oftentimes there's a perfect storm of several things occurring all at once. So in someone who's older, maybe having an abnormal heart rhythm or having very high blood pressure might be enough to trigger an injury to the brain. But in someone who's younger, oftentimes they're actually quite healthy or their bodies are able to resist injury much more. And so we know that in most of our studies, about half of young adults actually have a stroke related to something that's going on in the heart. There's a common condition that's called a Patent's foramen ovale, which is a small hole in the heart that many people are born with. Actually, all of us are born with, but in about 80% of us, it closes on its own. But in some people, it actually can cause a problem later. For about a 25% to 30% of people, they have something that's wrong with the blood vessels, whether there's a tear in the blood vessel because there's some susceptibility to injury there, or maybe it's because there's something that causes the blood vessels to squeeze too much so that oxygen and nutrients can't get through them. And then for the rest, there are dozens of other potential reasons, but they're much more myriad and varied than they are in older adults.
Well, this is such an important topic to so many of our listeners, and we're grateful to have this time with you. We do need to take a short break. For our listeners, when we return, we'll continue talking with Amy Edmonds, stroke survivor and founder and chief executive of Young Stroke, and Dr. Lester Lung, a neurologist and director of the Stroke and Young Adults Program at Tufts Medical Center, about this alarming rate of young stroke victims. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You listen to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Amy Edmonds, stroke survivor and founder and chief executive of Young Stroke, and Dr. Lester Lung, neurologist and director of the Stroke and Young Adults Program at Tufts Medical Center, about the rate of young stroke victims. And Dr. Lung, perhaps you should tell us, what is the kind of rate of strokes among younger, and is this something that is increasing, and why?
I think that's a great question, and one that, that we're trying to clarify more. There is the sense that we are seeing more young adults with stroke, but one question is it truly that there are more people who have this, or is it actually just a greater proportion of the people that we're seeing come to the hospital as a result of more recognition or sort of more of a sense from the general public that people who are young can have strokes? I also think it's actually really important to recognize that some people think of stroke as being something that just happens once and doesn't happen again. So it's kind of a one-and-done deal. You just look for new cases, and that's the number you use. And if that is the number you use, then strokes represent about 10 to 15% of all new cases of stroke. So per 100,000 people in a year, that's probably around 32 to 45 people per 100,000 in terms of young adults with stroke. But I think a lot of us, I think Amy and I share the same philosophy that stroke is actually something that people live with for their whole lives in some way, and that it's more of a chronic condition that they have to deal with. And if you look at it that way, someone who's had a stroke when they're 25 or 35 or 45 is going to live with this for many, many more years of their lives. And if you look at prevalence, how many people are out there who are people who have survived a stroke and are moving beyond that, you actually find that there are millions of young adults with stroke, and it actually represents about a quarter to a third of all people in the U.S. with stroke.
Wow. I mean, that's astounding to think of how common it is and how many people out there are living with, as you describe, a chronic condition. And Ms. Edmonds, you shared with us before the break some about your experience living life after having had a stroke. But tell us about what you've done with that experience. You founded Young Stroke, and we'd love to hear more about its work and mission.
Well, my stroke occurred in January, and by December I had enrolled in graduate school because I'm someone who needs information, and I was desperate to understand why an otherwise healthy person like myself had experienced a stroke. And in graduate school, my research focus became stroke in young adults, and that was very significant for me because it really opened my awareness to the tremendous research around this subject, but regrettably, the majority of it was happening outside of our country. And so that became a point of interest, and I was thinking, so why aren't we talking about this diagnosis more in America? And it occurred to me from my research that it was largely because we didn't have a voice of advocacy to exclusively focus upon the emerging population of young adults experiencing stroke in America. And so as a part of my master's thesis, I proposed that if I ruled the world, I would create such an organization, and I would call it Young Stroke. And so that was really how we got started. And the mission of Young Stroke, of course, is to benefit young adults who have experienced a first stroke prior to age 65, as well as their caregivers. And we accomplish our mission through education and research. And with education, we are trying to help bring awareness to healthcare professionals with CME offerings. And so for the past 2 years, we hosted the first international conference on this topic to help support that part of our mission. And then we're also trying to drive research by helping to facilitate connections between researchers and also trying to facilitate connections with the young stroke community to help provide a gateway to the survivor community for researchers to conduct much needed studies.
And Dr. Lung, how did you come across and meet Amy? Because you're up in the Mecca of Boston. Amy, you're in South Carolina?
Yes.
Yeah, so those two things don't seem to necessarily, you would make that a connection necessarily, but you guys have connected. And also, Dr. Lung, tell us about what is the cutting edge of the research you're doing?
Yeah, it's been my my honor to work with Amy and to be able to engage with the Young Stroke group. the way we connected is just that we have this common and shared interest and sort of a shared mission to try and help people who have had strokes at a young age and make things better for this group. It just involved an email and a phone call, and then we were able to begin our work together. For me, I think in terms of the research that we're doing and the kind of work that we're doing up here in Boston, it's really the idea is we're really trying to build a new model of care for how the healthcare system, how doctors and nurses and others help people who are young adults with stroke, because I think they're not actually, our current system isn't really necessarily meeting all their needs. This is something that we found just taking care of people. And so our philosophy is really kind of three things. One is to listen, two is to act, and three is to learn. And so we started out just by listening to what people needed, what they were experiencing, what are the issues that they came up with a month after stroke or a year after stroke. And then we started building in new clinical practices, whether they're screening practices or different types of therapies, connecting them with different types of specialists. And then finally, the learning part is both for the survivors themselves, but also research standpoints. We have a lot of survivorship activities to try and help people learn from one another in terms of how to move forwards. And then from the research side of things, we're really engaging people in terms of trying to see what's important to them or what are the things when they look back on their experiences that prevented them from getting to the hospital in time or what sort of things do they need going forwards.
And so in thinking about this, you both have programs that I see are synergistic to one another. But I'm also wondering if we have listeners who are stroke survivors and would be interested in exploring resources that are in their area or would be interested in participating in research in some way to help forward the cause. Is there a way to tap into that if you're not in the South Carolina or Tufts area, or we're just hoping that you're building it and it'll build and extend across the nation?
Well, certainly anyone may reach out to Young Stroke. We do have a limited number of contacts across the country to enable us to sometimes refer people to resources within their own state or perhaps something within their region. But generally, I always encourage people to start local and go to your hospital or your provider and ask if there may be a stroke support group. Regrettably, many times, typical support groups may be responsive only to more geriatric patients, and so younger survivors sometimes don't feel very comfortable in that type of environment. But I always encourage people that they only need just one good friend, and it may be their provider may be able to connect them with one or two people that they could just meet for coffee or perhaps, start something as simple as an email exchange, because it doesn't have to be a formal group that provides you with support. And for that reason, many young stroke survivors tap into many of the social media outlets that are currently available. There are a number of online links that many people who are in rural settings, find particularly beneficial just to be able, to make that connection with someone that's a peer.
I'll speak from our end, but it really is something that mirrors what Amy has talked about. But for us, with our program, we're trying to essentially build a playbook for how other doctors and nurses and patient navigators and coordinators can help build similar programs in other parts of the country and other parts of the world. But something that we found too, especially with our stroke survivors, is that one being a part of our program, they really do reach out to others around them and people gravitate towards them. And so a lot of the reach of the people who have come to our program has really extended across our state, and we're hoping to move even beyond that through social media and other means.
Well, we want to thank really both of you, Amy Edwins and Dr. Lester Long, for the work you're doing in advocacy and education. Really quite remarkable. I know, Amy, you've done work in the South Carolina legislature, and we're going to make links to Young Stroke and your work, Dr. Long, because I do think that people who are advocates can spring up anywhere and everywhere, and you're doing work that can be replicated. Not you, but the important work that you're doing can be, others can take inspiration. So thank you so much for being Your Health guest.
Thank you both.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
Christy, if a listener has a question or an issue they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send a comment or a question to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today about something I don't think we've actually spoken about on the show in all these years, called acoustic neuroma.
My aunt was having tinnitus for about a year and was recently diagnosed with an acoustic neuroma. What is it?
Great question. Scary sort of topic, but maybe we can help demystify it and it won't be quite as scary.
Yeah. So this is something that I agree, Adam, can be scary when you hear it because it is a brain tumor. But an acoustic neuroma is also called a vestibular schwannoma.
Well, that helps.
That clears everything up, right? Okay, we're done. No, but this is a rare benign tumor, meaning it's a tumor that grows but doesn't usually spread throughout the body. And usually these are on one side of the brain. They sort of grow along the nerves of the balance and hearing nerves. And it usually presents like what you're describing with your aunt, where it's one-sided ear ringing or tinnitus and usually has hearing loss associated with it.
So a tumor that's growing along the nerve inside the brain and the ear doesn't sound very good.
It doesn't sound good.
And, you know, this ringing of the ear, which is a frequent kind of problem, is a presenting aspect of this, along with kind of losing your hearing, which is also something that happens real frequent. So we should say at the outset, the great majority of people who have ringing in their ears and lose their hearing, it's not this tumor. But doctors will think about this, and if it's a sudden loss of hearing and it's one-sided with the ringing, well, those sort of things would kind of say maybe you should have this evaluated with an MRI, which is what you would probably need to diagnose it.
And the good news is they are usually very slow growing, so you usually have time to sort it out. And that with surgery and sometimes with radiation, they can be removed. And usually people go on to be able to have a normal life. I have had a patient who's had ongoing problems with hearing and a little bit of a facial droop where her muscles don't work quite as well on that side related to her acoustic neuroma and its removal. But she's gone on to have a very long and happy life.
Well, and the nice part is we do want to pick these up earlier because the treatment is easier. You know, they most can be cured with surgery, but much easier and less disability when you get them out earlier. So I think this is one of those things that if you're aware of it, if you have a relative or you have, you know, hearing loss with some ringing, you should probably ask your doctor, should I worry about, if you don't remember acoustic neuroma, just say a tumor of the nerve of the ear. They'll know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. They will. We wish your aunt all the best, and it sounds like she's getting very good care.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
Why do I get skin tags and how do I get rid of them?
That's a really good question. And it's actually one I just had a patient ask me that the other day, a patient who has skin tags really all over her. And they're annoying and she's been asking me to help her remove them, which I've been doing. Why do you get them? There's a lot of different factors involved, but for most people, there might be a genetic part, like if it runs in your family. But for a lot of people, it's weight related. So if you are obese or if you have certain weight related illnesses like diabetes or high cholesterol or other things, you're more likely to have these skin tags.
On the other hand, skin tags are just really common. Like half the population probably has at least one skin tag, and they kind of get more infrequent with age. They also see them in women who are pregnant. The nice thing is that they can be removed really easily too. You don't have to remove them, but you could start to remove them. There's called a snip excision. Basically, you take a pair of scissors and cut them, maybe numb them up because
you don't do that at home.
Yeah, don't do it at home. Or a doctor will freeze them off. A lot of different ways that are kind of easy to treat them. You know, if you never had them before and you were overweight and all of a sudden you got a bunch, I think probably getting tested for diabetes wouldn't be a bad idea.
Right. But they are very easy to remove in the office, something your primary care doctor can do. And so it's worth, if they're bothering you or irritating you, talking to your doctor about it and either getting your main doctor or dermatologist to remove them for you.
Yeah. And they can bleed actually a fair amount. So that's why you wouldn't want to do it at home because it could like stain your shirt.
Well, and I'm also picturing like dirty scissors and
we don't want to go there.
You'd rather get that done in the office.
Sounds good.
Okay. Let's have our next house call, Laura.
My son just came home with a stomach bug. I'd really like to avoid a house full of people with the stomach bug. What's the best way to prevent that?
Can we put your son in isolation?
Yes. We've decided it's isolation, complete isolation.
That's what we do with epidemics.
Yeah, well, that's not very practical for families and young
children.
That seems
a little excessive, yes.
No, and I had a dear friend who had, within 14 hours, all five members of her family were having the stomach bug, vomiting, and diarrhea at the same time. So you're wise to try to prevent it going through your whole family. And there are no magic answers other than what we know. I mean, the most important thing is really frequent hand washing, wiping down all the counters, making sure you're aware that those germs are passed. When you're taking care of a baby, it's hard not to get them on your hands, but you just have to keep washing, and keep things as clean as you can.
What do you think about face masks, either for the son who's got the stomach bug or yourself wearing a face mask?
I mean, I guess it'd be worth trying. I mean, there is nothing worse than throwing up. I also feel like, I don't know, as a mom, in times when I've been taking care of my babies throwing up, I want them to see my face and know that I love them and I'm there for them. But I also
that isolation
want to
room.
Turn
that,
my
head how about that isolation room that has glass all the way around it with one of those teller windows? And here's your food. No, okay, we're not. Okay, I'm going to get. Listen, I'm just joking.
He is kidding.
Okay, what's our very last house call?
I talk with a certain family member almost daily, and I'm beginning to worry that this person is drinking more than usual. How can you tell if a family member's increased drinking is a problem?
That's a problem.
You hear me take a big sigh. Yeah. If you notice it, probably is a problem.
Right. It's that instinct. It's like if you have to ask the question, you're probably that your suspicion is worried enough. And I would really just say, you know, what exactly is the behaviors that you're noticing? Like, is this person drinking 2 to 4 drinks every time you guys go out together? You go over their house and they seem to always have a couple drinks, and it's, you know, where you see them drinking earlier in the day. What's happening?
And then initiating that talk openly out of a spirit of care and concern for this family member is helpful. And then also just gathering a little bit of information in terms of maybe resources in the community. You could talk to your doctor about that. And also to realize that risky drinking is really easy for people to do. I feel like people come and they have a glass of wine at dinner. And then for a woman, if you have a glass of wine at dinner every night of the week and then you have more on the weekends, well, you're technically in that category of risky drinking. That's too much for a woman's liver. A man can have a couple beers a day, but if you do that every single night of the week and more on the weekends, well, that's actually really risky drinking. And so sometimes people don't realize quite how much they're taking in.
Doctors will sometimes assess by two different ways. One is called a CAGE. So you could ask your relative, have you ever had to cut down on the amounts you drink? That's the C, the A of the K's. You ever get angry if I were to tell you drink too much? The G, guilt. Do you feel guilty that you may drink too much? And then do they ever have one in the morning? That's the E, the eye opener. If they answer yes to really any one of those four, that may be a problem. And then there's another question you can ask, which is just one question, which is ask them, do you ever feel like you drink too much and you need to cut back? If they answer kind of yes to that, that's in and of itself is a real problem and red flag. Well, that'll conclude our house calls, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can send your own comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes, or search our health app.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guests today, Amy Edmonds and Dr. Lester Long. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.